Support for Louisiana Eats comes from Zatarain's Hot Sauce, specially blended for poor boys, red beans and rice, jambalaya, and all of your favorite Louisiana Eats. From our studios in the Southern Food and Beverage Museum in New Orleans, this is Louisiana Eats. I'm Poppy Tooker. This week's Louisiana Eats is simply a feast for the senses. We begin with a feast for the eyes. That's the name of an international photography exhibit on display through September 16th at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum in Baton Rouge. We'll explore the history and inspiration of food photography with curators Denise Wolf and Elizabeth Weinstein. Then, our sensory feast continues with the olfactory. It may surprise you just how much the nose brings to the tasting table. Author Molly Birnbaum recalls her personal nightmare when an accident robbed her of the sense of smell, potentially train-wrecking her dreams of a culinary career. And what about the sense of sight? Are there blind chefs? New Orleans' own Pinky Harris answers that question with a resounding yes. Pinky shares her inspirational story. Set the table. It's a feast for all the senses on this week's Louisiana Eats.
My name is Denise Wolf, and I'm one of the co-curators of Feast for the Eyes, the story of food and photography, along with Susan Bright, who's the co-curator and author of the book.
For as long as artists have rendered portraits of people, they've also portrayed the food that people eat. Denise and her co-curator Susan have put together an expansive collection of food photography, running the gamut from 1930s documentary photographs to the most cutting-edge experimental photography of today. Fortunately for us, the Feast for the Eyes exhibit began its tour at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum in Baton Rouge. Next stop on the tour? Amsterdam. New York-based curator Denise Wolf met us at the museum for a tour of the exhibit before sharing the amazing collection's backstory. She began by describing the earliest forms of food photography.
Whatever the subject of your photograph was, you needed to be near the chemistry. And food was something that people had around. It was in their homes. It could be near anywhere. And so a lot of the first subjects in photography were still life, were foods, along with flowers and other things. So you see from the very start of photographs, this is a subject. And in the very beginning, they're often copying still life tradition in art. And so you see them when they're using an apple, it's the forbidden apple. It has all these symbolisms, and the kind of hanging game was, came right out of Dutch still life. But they're trying to do something that only photography could do, which was to really, really describe in minute detail, and it looks real. And a painting could do that, but not the same way. And so they're highlighting that from the very beginning.
I have always been so fascinated by the work of the WPA and the New Deal. How in the world did food come to figure in this?
Well, during the, there was the historical project of the Farm Security Agency during the New Deal, and photographers were sent out to document agricultural revitalization that was happening. And even though they were there to document that, they were encouraged by Roy Stryker, who I believe ran the program, to speak in their own voice. And so you have highly original work coming out of that time period by these FSA photographers, Russell Lee being one of them.
Tell us about Russell Lee and who he photographed.
Russell Lee was a Farm Security Agency photographer, and the photographs we have here are from Pie Town, New Mexico. It was named Pie Town because it was known for its great pies, in comparison to some of the cookbooks and cookbooklets that were coming out as propaganda at the time, here you have a real authentic picture of a small town in America. They are poor, they're possibly hungry, but there's also a strong sense of community. So you see them out cooking at the fair and sharing food at the same time. So they're really quite beautiful, I think.
Why am I surprised by color photography in those sort of gritty 1930s Depression era photographs?
You're surprised because color photography at that point would have been associated with commercial work. So what would appear in a cookbook or on food packaging or cookbooklets, it wasn't necessarily associated with documentary photography or even art photography. So it was pretty radical that Russell Lee decided to photograph in color. And many of the FSA photographers photographed in black and white, like Walker Evans, for instance. But Russell Lee photographed Pie Town in 35 millimeter color. So it's a special treat that he did that.
Could you tell us a little bit about how color changed things in food?
Well, certainly food was a big driver of color photography because if you notice in the exhibit, a lot of times some of the cookbooks, you'll see a black and white picture on the left page, say, and a color picture on the right, and you get right away why you'd want something in color, because it looks so much more appetizing, so much better. And so color was a way for food to be more appetizing, so you'd use that to sell more food. So packaging, cookbooks, brands, those are things where they were immediately using color.
You all also make a point about how food photographs can easily shift from delicious to disgusting. There's a series of Japanese photographs, and tell me how you think that slide occurs.
Well, I think that's what's interesting about food and photographs is that on one sense, eating is kind of gross. You know, it's moving from inside to outside. Your, you know, chewed up food is gross. And on the other side, it's the kind of highest form of our culture. You know, it can be the most sophisticated thing. And that's happening in photographs, too. And so some are very gorgeous and beautiful and sophisticated and like relating a certain lifestyle, and others are absolutely disgusting. And so it can symbolize excess, too. And I think the photographer you're referring to is Araki, and that series of very, very close-up food is about desire and almost an excess, gluttonous desire. But there's plenty of others in the exhibition that are a little bit more about kind of food fight or a kind of American gross-out, which is something we see a lot in our culture. And so it's always on that knife edge with the pictures. It's like the pictures, you could easily see even the most fancy, most refined pictures going into food fight the minute after it ended.
Denise, I loved when you pointed out to me that we all know Betty Crocker and we all know Aunt Jemima and folks like that who figure largely in that American post-World War II propaganda. But we did have food. And yet you showed me illustrations from other countries of things they couldn't possibly be able to cook and eat. Tell me about that propagandizing.
Well, that's also happening around that post-war. We have a little section of post-war cookbooks, post-World War II. And so almost as soon as the war ends, some of these very colorful, lavishly illustrated cookbooks are coming out. And just like Betty Crocker is unrealistic, you're really not going to put out that garden supper that they have depicted. It's something to dream about. Sure, maybe someone can, but you're not. It is a form of propaganda put out by a brand. There's other cookbooks that are put out by the state. So there's this Russian book called The Book of Tasty and Healthy Food that was put out in the hundreds of thousands by the state. And those have these beautiful chromolithographs. And those are more focused on the Russian product, the Russian worker, the society, feeding the society at large. But they're much more pared down, and they're featuring things like eggs. Eggs are not available in Russia at that time, and many of the products are luxury products or products that are not available anywhere. So it's a real aspirational view of communism that they're sending out to and providing to the people as well. And so it's a different type of dreaming that's going on there. And you see it also even in France or Italy or Germany, where some of the pictures are including cakes and things where there, flour, sugar, eggs, those are things that were very scarce during the war and even post-war. And yet there are photographs featuring beautiful cakes. And so it's something to dream about. It's to get people moving and thinking about their culture and their nationality again, and rebuilding that after the war.
That whole section over there is brilliant because, you know, there's this fine line between what is art and what is commercial. And so for an artist to have thought to take something very commercial, because love the chocolate popsicle right next door to the man witch, and when all of the advertising words are removed, it becomes very different.
You can almost see their messaging more when you're forced to, first of all, see it at a large size, but when everything else is removed from it, you start to question how we were sold things and what this says that this picture could sell us something.
I have to say, I never thought about using eggs and mortadella to decorate my home.
That's true. That's something an artist, Sean Bonnell, she was playing on this idea of the housewife, the housekeeper, and homekeeping, and used cold cuts as the backsplash. And a very surreal housekeeping. But that's almost the art of the double take. So if you're walking by that quickly, it might just look like a beautifully decorated bathroom tile. And then you take another look and you see, oh, it's salami.
It's really very compelling. And there's lots of other. I mean, my goodness, you even have some little tiny Polaroid of Andy Warhol's work. How fascinating that that's how he worked.
I don't think a lot of people knew, or maybe they did, but I didn't know that he often took Polaroids of different foods and different things, banal subjects that he was then going to paint or silkscreen later, and he would move the lighting and the shadows and the relationships of the food in Polaroid first. So it's interesting to see how he shot it on Polaroid and then how they became the paintings later. But isn't that interesting how you can look at a photograph and it can make you hungry? And that is one of the things that's very special about food in photography, is that that doesn't necessarily happen with a painting of food, and it doesn't happen necessarily with photographs of other subject matter, but this actually, you have a bodily response to it, and that's part of what makes it very powerful.
I just want to thank you so much for bringing the exhibit here to Louisiana and giving us all a little glimpse of this feast for the eyes. It really is, and thank you.
Well, it was the perfect place to start because Louisiana has such a rich tradition of cuisine and food, and you take your food very seriously. So I hope you come out and enjoy it.
I need a camera to my eye, to my eye. Remind him.
Denise Wolf, co-curator of the Feast for the Eyes exhibit, on view at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum in Baton Rouge, now through September 16th. Showcasing over 100 photos by everyone from Irving Penn to Cindy Sherman, the Feast for the Eyes at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum brings a lot to the table. But as we quickly discovered, the traveling exhibit is only the feast's first course.
My name is Elizabeth Weinstein, and I'm the Assistant Director for Interpretation and Chief Curator at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum.
To complement the traveling photography exhibit, Elizabeth Weinstein has worked to provide visitors with a whole gamut of food-related programming this year.
Well, the Louisiana Art and Science Museum, obviously, is an art museum and a science museum, and we really strive to connect the two in as many ways as possible. It makes for a much richer experience. There's something for everyone. There is, for instance, an area where you can learn about calories and ride a bike. You can learn about My Plate, which I learned replaced the food pyramid that I had as a kid, to learn about balanced meals and nutrition. And then there's an activity that goes along with that. There are still lives that we set up to really hone in on the still life aspect of the exhibition and how photography began with that. But we went back to creating actual still lives where you can draw. We have several hands-on galleries in the museum. One is for our youngest visitors. We affectionately call it Discovery Depot because we're housed in a 1925 train station, passenger train station. And in that area, we heightened up the food activity where you can play in the kitchen. You can do a crawfish boil. We added some mini photography studios where they can set up their own food still life. Can't have real food in there, I'm afraid, but they can set up their own pretend still life and take a picture of it.
And such an amazing adjunct part of this exhibit is your Food Glorious food display. Tell us about that.
We involve local artists and Louisiana artists whenever we can. We have begun an annual series. This is the fourth one, called Capital City Contemporary, to really spotlight the contributions of artists to the vitality of our city and our state's art scene. Each time it's a different theme, no more than a dozen artists. And this year, of course, food was such a compelling topic, we actually changed the date of it from the fall to the summer to be able to be in companion with it. Different mediums, different styles. The artists are at different stages in their career. Kind of gives a snapshot of what different artists in our community, how they're depicting food, which of course is something we're all so familiar with, but yet look at in so many different ways.
I am really proud of the incredible work that's been curated here locally at the museum. So thank you for your incredible work. And I hope everybody beats a quick path to your door because this is an exhibit that really shouldn't be missed.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
That was Elizabeth Weinstein, Chief Curator at the Louisiana Art and Science Museum. After a short break, author Molly Birnbaum shares the story of losing her sense of smell and how it changed her relationship with food forever. Stay with us. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Rouse's Markets, from Camellia Brand, Beans Done Right, a New Orleans tradition since 1923, and from the Napoleon House, located in the historic French Quarter, home of the Pimm's Cup cocktail and the toasted muffalata. Lunch, dinner, and private events at 500 Charter Street. Do you have some Louisiana Eats on your mind? We'd like to hear about it, so we've opened a phone line to take your calls. Leave us a message at 504-867-9128 or send us an email to louisianaeats@poppytooker.com. And now, back to Louisiana Eats. We now turn to the dynamo of senses, and one that's too often taken for granted, olfaction. In addition to guarding us against sour milk and stovetop fires, our sense of smell works together with taste to help us detect the flavors in our food. If you've ever eaten a meal with a stuffy nose, you may discover that your food is bland and less appetizing. Doctors call this anosmia, the loss of smell, and it's a condition suffered by millions of Americans. Often caused by a nasal condition or brain injury, the effects of anosmia can be devastating, especially for someone with culinary aspirations. In the summer of 2005, Molly Birnbaum was a 22-year-old Brown University graduate about to enroll in the Culinary Institute of America to train as a chef. All that changed when she suffered a dreadful accident that resulted not only in broken bones, but the loss of her sense of smell. Molly writes about her experience in her memoir, Season to Taste, and joined me in the Louisiana Eats studio to talk about it. She began by describing what happened that day that forever changed her life.
Well, I was working in Boston at the time, and I went for a jog one morning, as I often did. I was living at my mother's house at the time in Brookline, and I went for a run. I was jogging up the street and came to an intersection, a four-lane highway, and it had a light, and I, you know, thought it was the time to go, so I just went straight across, and I was hit by a car.
So when did you discover that you'd lost your sense of smell?
It took weeks before I discovered that I couldn't smell, and that was in part because I was injured in so many other places. I tore the ligaments in my knee, I broke my pelvis, I fractured my skull. I was not with it for a while. But a couple of weeks later, I was recovering in my parents' house, and my stepmother, Cindy, decided to bake an apple crisp. I was having a hard time eating. You know, I wasn't feeling well at all. And she thought this would help. It was one of my favorite desserts, you know, the apples and the cinnamon. It was fall time. It was, you know, reminiscent of my childhood. But when she took the crisp out of the oven, I was in a room with family and a friend or two, and everyone was oohing and aahing over the scent of this dessert. And I breathed in, and I couldn't smell anything. And I thought, you know, this is strange. Maybe someone's in my way, you know, maybe something was blocking the scent from reaching me. But when she took it out and brought it to the room and held it under my nose and I breathed in, I could feel the heat, the thick heat of the steam in my nose, but there was nothing else. And that's when I realized that something was truly wrong.
And what happened as a result of the accident was your olfactory nerves had actually detached, correct?
Well, what happened, I later learned, is that when I fractured my skull, and it was the back of my skull against the windshield of this car, so there was a big impact, a thump, and my brain bounced within my skull. And when it bounced at the front, it severed the olfactory neurons, which snake from the nose to the brain, kind of sheared them off with it, the impact, kind of like a lawnmower over grass. And so in one split second, they were just completely detached and no longer able to transmit these signals.
Explain to us the complexity of how the sense of smell works in humans.
Well, it is complex, and it is one of the least studied senses, so there are still many questions left. But basically, when we inhale over an apple crisp, there are hundreds of scent molecules that enter in our noses, travel up to the top, and are received by the olfactory receptors, which then transmit signals from our nose to our brain. And these signals are patterns. You know, all of the different molecules send very different signals over many, many different neurons. And so it's almost like reading sheet music. The brain interprets these signals to be cinnamon or apples or sugar. And it's not entirely clear how we interpret these signals, but nonetheless, we do get that scent.
Well, you know, I have long been an advocate about how important our taste memories are. I've often said that I believe your heartstrings are tied directly to your taste buds, but you made me realize that it does have a lot more to do with scent. Give me some examples of some things that maybe you lose memories and such as a result of this.
Oh, completely. Smell is so intricately intertwined with memories. I think we've all had experiences in which we encounter a familiar but surprising scent, and it sends us straight back to a moment when we're little. And it's usually not just a moment. It's an emotional, you know, gut-punching type of moment. Smell is very connected to memory in our brains. And so I think that that translates to being in the kitchen and smelling cinnamon or nutmeg and remembering Christmas, or chicken roasting in the oven, remembering our mother's kitchen when we were little.
Tell me how the loss of the sense of smell affected your life.
It affected it greatly. When I lost my sense of smell, I had been training to be a chef. I was in love with food. I was passionate about cooking. I wanted nothing more than to, you know, spend my life in the kitchen and feed people. But without a sense of smell, I lost flavor, basically. I had known that smell and taste were connected, but I didn't realize by how much, how powerful smell was when it came to eating and tasting. So without a sense of smell, I had the salty, sweet, bitter, sour, and umami of my taste buds on my tongue. You know, I could taste salt. I could taste sugar. I had temperature and texture, but very little else. I didn't have spice or herb, all of the nuance that makes food recognizable or good. So without a sense of smell, food became mute and bland. Everything tasted the same. It was very difficult.
It was depressing, wasn't it?
It was incredibly depressing. You know, walking into a kitchen where someone is cooking, where it would once be butter and garlic, was just flat and plain. I couldn't tell when I was hungry. I couldn't tell when food was in the kitchen, when I ate it. You know, it was like my world had gone from color to black and white.
I was particularly fascinated by one of the things that it seemed you enjoyed eating at that time that involved a familiar Louisiana ingredient and some bread.
Oh, Tabasco sauce. I ate it on everything because I could feel the spiciness. I mean, that's a tingling of the nerves in the mouth. I could feel that. And it made food feel more alive. So I ate Tabasco on everything. But to help my sense of smell come back, I had begun talking to scientists and perfumers, you know, trying to get answers. What was going on in my nose? Why did this mean so much? Why weren't there answers of how I could recover? And many of them told me that though it was not foolproof, smelling things would help me to retrain my sense of smell, to help get it back. And that could be just taking spices out of my cupboard and smelling them one after another. That's one of the most fascinating things about the sense of smell, is that our olfactory neurons have the ability to regenerate and regrow. And even in a healthy nose, your olfactory neurons are constantly regenerating. You have new olfactory neurons. I've heard that in rats it's 30 days. I'm not sure what it is in humans, but it's relatively frequent.
So, Molly, what did you do to go about regaining your sense of smell?
I was lucky. My sense of smell began to return on its own very slowly over the course of years. And the first scent returned, and it was one scent at a time. And I was chopping fresh rosemary. I was helping my mother to cook dinner, and I was chopping it for a marinade. And there was nothing. I was chopping, and then all of a sudden, the smell just hit me, and it was, you know, glorious, dark green and earthy and herby, and reminded me of a moment in my childhood, of course, when I rode a horse for the first time out west. But after I got over the glee of just being able to smell anything again, I began to realize that I couldn't recognize smells that I think before the accident would have been so familiar. The words to label them would have come, you know, right to my mouth. But that was gone. And so I tried to train my nose so that I could recognize smells again in the way that I did before, kind of relearning how to smell, relearning all of the scents that were present in my daily life. It was all good scents in the beginning, rosemary and chocolate, cucumbers, which I hadn't even realized had a scent before it came back. I even went so far as to go to perfume school and smell raw perfume materials over and over, and that really did help.
Do you still suffer any residual effects?
Well, I think that I can smell today, better than I could before. And I'm not sure that's because I can smell more or more intensely, but simply that I pay so much attention to scent now, and smelling things and labeling things and just being aware. So I think that the only residual effects right now are good ones.
A season to taste is a very personal and intimate look at your life. Why did you write the book?
I wrote this book because when I lost my sense of smell, I felt so lost, frankly, and I didn't have answers. No one could tell me why this happened, what would happen to me in the future, and how I could make sense of my place within this disability. And through the course of these questions, I began to meet hundreds of people who had likewise lost their sense of smell and felt its effects as much as I did. So I knew that I wasn't alone, and I knew that other people also didn't have answers. So as I went through this process talking to scientists and perfumers and chefs and flavorists, you know, I realized that there was a story to tell here that was much larger than my own. In America, 1-2% of the population cannot smell, which translates to millions of people. And you can lose your sense of smell through a head injury like mine, or simply a cold. A virus can wipe it out. And as we age, we all lose a little bit of our ability to smell. So I think it's much more common than most people realize.
Well, I'm thrilled that you were able to come and talk with us today. And I want to thank you so much. And please come back to New Orleans and have another sniff and taste of us soon.
Oh, I will. Thank you.
Molly Birnbaum, author of A Season to Taste. People from all around the world know the iconic sights and gyrating sounds of New Orleans, but only the locals know it by another sense. Writer Scott Gold brings us this ode to the olfactory.
When people fall in love with New Orleans, a phenomenon that happens on a daily basis around here, they're wont to wax poetically about the familiar qualities that make this city such a special and enchanting place. But all of this gushing tends to leave out a single and singular fact of life in the Crescent City. This town, for lack of a better word, smells. For me, it all starts with the Holy Trinity and the Pope. No, I'm not talking about religion. I'm talking about cooking. The base for all great Cajun and Creole dishes is our local version of mirepoix, a classic combination of chopped carrots, celery, and onions used to initiate stocks and stews and so forth in traditional French cuisine. Only in New Orleans, this trinity substitutes green bell peppers for carrots and adds garlic, known colloquially here as the Pope, owing to the bulb's similarity to a papal headpiece. Proust had his Madeleines. I have the Holy Trinity. And food-wise, it's not just the scent of sautéing trinity that rings my nostalgia center like a cathedral bell. There's coffee. I spent my latter high school years studying in local independent coffee houses, long before the advent of veinty iced mocha pumpkin spice skinny frappuccinos. The smell of the place, the richness of those dark beans with chicory, will always bring me back to those beautiful moments, if only for a short spell. Then, of course, there are the distinctive smells of the Big Easy that aren't easily, or even possibly, replicated elsewhere. Our abundant natural splendor factors in heavily here. Anyone who isn't entranced by the olfactory dynamite that sets off during a New Orleans spring probably doesn't deserve to be here in the first place. Between the Confederate jasmine, the sweet olive, gardenias, magnolia flowers, and, if you're lucky, blooming angel's trumpets, it's difficult, if not impossible, for a person's nose to not fall headlong in passionate love with this town. Then we have the smells of carnival season. Cheap plastic beads, cotton candy, king cake, diesel fumes, that unmistakable green and skunky aroma of something illicit somewhere, and, this must be mentioned, the singular scent of Popeye's chicken and biscuits. Being able to identify the smell of Popeye's blindfolded at the drop of a hat should be a litmus test for anyone wanting to call themselves a local in the city. which is not to say that all New Orleans smells are favorable ones. Along with all the glorious scents of the Crescent City, we also have that heady perfume of rue bourbon, a pungent brew of stale beer, cigarettes, manure from the tourist buggies and police horses, hot garbage, hobo body odor, and that unmistakable smell of whatever horrifying toxic brew lives in the craggy potholes of the quarter. If you distilled the essence of this combination into an atomizable liquid, I'm sure it would quickly be banned by the Geneva Convention as an agent of chemical warfare. But for all the cringing these scents might cause, they're worth it for the good ones, the magical ones that enrapture, ensnare, and envelop us so deeply and completely in a way that no other city can. So you can keep your Madeleines, Marcel. I've got my sautéed Trinity, my Confederate Jasmine, my boiled crawfish, and yes, even Bourbon Street. And I wouldn't trade those for the world.
That was writer and native New Orleanian Scott Gold. This piece originally aired on WWNO's Notes from New Orleans and was produced by Thomas Walsh. Now that we've done so much olfactory exploration, what about the nose of wine? Stay tuned, and we'll investigate that concept when we come right back. Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Louisiana Eats is brought to you with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen and Zatarain's. Are you podcasting Louisiana Eats yet? If not, it's time to subscribe. Our latest podcast explores the life and work of Italy's most renowned butcher, Dario Caccini, one of the most inspiring culinarians I've ever had the pleasure to meet. Dario and his recent apprentice, Richard Brennan III, are slated for an upcoming edition of Louisiana Eats, but our podcast listeners will be treated to a meaty serving of the man who's been described as a personality, a celebrity, a theatrical host, a showstopper, and a butcher extraordinaire. Just visit poppytooker.com to hear Dario's podcast. And while you're there, check out our new videos by filmmakers Marion Gay and Jonathan Evans. Now, back to Louisiana Eats. Here's this week's culinary quiz question, brought to you with support from Popeye's Louisiana Culinary Institute. So what about the nose of wine? When you breathe in deeply from a wine glass, you're literally nose to nose with the wine. Your nose identifies aromas through orthonasal olfaction. The wine's nose offers the grape derivatives of fruit, herbs, and flowers, while secondary aromas come from how the wine was made. And then the tertiary aromas come from aging, either in oak casks or in the bottle. Those aromas are savory, like roasted nuts, vanilla, and sometimes baking spices. When it comes to how your wine tastes, it's really the nose that knows. But what about the mouth's role at this party? That wine easily slips past the lips, delivering a panoply of flavors. But have you ever thought about how something feels in your mouth? When it comes to mouthfeel, nothing quite stacks up to roasted okra. If you've never eaten roasted okra, even if you believe you hate okra, you've got to give this a try. It's super easy, just takes 15 minutes, and as you begin to chew on a roasted okra spear, instead of the slime that's often a big okra turnoff, the high roasting temperature turns that notoriously mucilaginous substance into something that feels almost satiny in your mouth. It tastes delicious, and it's just such a pleasure to eat. You'll find the recipe at poppytooker.com. I'm Poppy Tooker, and you're listening to Louisiana Eats. Becoming a professional cook is no small undertaking for any person, but for Pinky Harris, learning to cook brought up an entirely different set of challenges because Pinky has been legally blind since birth. But this hasn't stopped her from working in some of Louisiana's finest restaurants and opening her own businesses. Pinky joined us in the studio to share her incredible story.
Hi, my name is Pinky Harris. I was born in a very small town in Virginia. Went to public school, grew up, went to Virginia Tech, where I majored in hospitality and tourism management. And once I figured out I could come to culinary school in New Orleans, I basically didn't look anywhere else. I knew that this is where my soul belonged, and I followed it home.
Tell me about your culinary training, your tour through New Orleans. Who all have you worked with?
I started at Baco. Worked the pantry and the pizza station there. The wood-burning pizza oven was one of my favorite stations I've ever worked. Then I moved on to Bella Luna. This really dates me. And made bread and did pastry with them for almost a year. Then I went to Muriel's as a pastry assistant. Then actually I went to Drago's as a pastry chef there. Then back to Muriel's, this time as a line cook, where I worked my way up. And Mandina's after the storm.
Now, Pinky, one of the things that listeners will find of tremendous interest is that you, in fact, are legally blind.
Yes.
You've been blind since when?
Since birth. It's actually a genetic mutation called albinism. When you're sitting in biology class in high school, you probably learned about it. It's a double recessive gene. Both parents have to have the gene, and both parents are carriers, but they don't always transmit the gene. So they both have to transmit that gene to the child, and it's basically 1 in 50,000 are the odds that somebody will be albino.
That's amazing. Explain the extent of vision.
I'm very lucky in that I have a wide range of vision. I have, you know, good peripheral vision. I don't have it's pretty much the same across the whole field of view that I have. The legally blind limit is 20 over 200, and I probably have 20 over 600, which I suppose if you want to quantify it in layman's terms, it's what someone with 20/20 would see at 60 feet is what I see at 1 foot. Print-wise, I see colors extremely well and variation of color extremely well, so I'm very blessed in that neighborhood. I can see things, but not the detail within those things.
When I thought about how it would be to be legally blind and working in a restaurant kitchen, I thought to myself, my goodness, a restaurant kitchen is kind of a dangerous place.
Kind of is.
Yeah, you know, filled with sharp objects and fire.
Everything's hot, heavy, or sharp.
So has that been a challenge in any way?
I will definitely admit, and anybody who's ever worked with me sitting out there listening will know that I have run into some things and tripped over some things in the floor and run into things periodically. And, you know, we all get cuts and scrapes and burns and things like that. And that's part of the territory. I wouldn't say that it's any more dangerous for me. I may run into the steam kettle if it's down, or, you know, if somebody leaves a Cambro in the middle of the floor, I'll probably surely trip over it. But other than that, I mean, it's just, you know, the same obstacles and, the same thing that everybody else deals with in the kitchen.
Yeah, we've all got those wicked brew burns, don't we?
Yes, exactly. Basically, the thing that really is impacted by my vision is the tickets. Can't read the print on the tickets. I have a small telescope that I use that's, if you can envision a pair of binoculars, but it will also focus very close up. So I have a tremendous range of vision with it. And so I can pull out of my pocket and read the tickets when I need to. But for, you know, regular cooking tasks, I really don't need it.
After spending over a decade working in commercial kitchens, in 2012, Pinky applied to become part of the Randolph Shepherd program. Shortly after receiving her operating license in 2014, she became manager of her own place, the Snack Bar, inside the Criminal Court Building at Tulane Avenue in New Orleans. Pinky's in the Court became a refuge for judges, attorneys, and jurors looking for a cup of coffee and a healthy meal. Pinky explained to us what the Randolph Shepherd program is all about.
Jennings Randolph and Mr. Shepherd were actually senators, and they are the two that sponsored the bill, which became known as the Randolph Shepherd Act. It's a federally mandated program. It was initiated in 1936 by an act of Congress, and it gives legally blind individuals priority on federal and state properties to run concession stands, and that varies wildly. It can be vending machines all the way up to a full-service cafeteria.
That is so interesting.
Yeah,
what
it's a great program.
What happened back in the 30s that caused them to create that?
I think it was, you know, part of the Great Depression, and the unemployment rate amongst legally blind people is astounding. It's 70% to 75%. And, you know, it's mainly because of discrimination, and people feel that, you know, blind individuals are a liability, so they don't want to hire them. So it was a way for blind people to have more employment opportunities, really. At its peak, in, I believe, the 80s, early 90s, there were 3,500 Randolph Shepherd vendors across the country. It's down to around 2,500 now.
That's really interesting. And the things that we live a long life and never know.
Never know. And you've run into Randolph Shepherd vendors and not known it at most courthouses and state buildings. In every building except the Capitol, in the Capitol complex in Baton Rouge, we have Randolph Shepherd stands there. Fort Polk, actually, in Louisiana, is run by a blind vendor. So all kinds of different places.
In 2017, Pinky opened up a new place in Gretna. She's now owner and manager of Pinky's Cafe, a sandwich shop found in the Jefferson Parish Government Complex. And if she wasn't busy enough these days, Pinky is now part owner and manager of a private venture, Bayou Throws, an operation that makes custom Mardi Gras beads and necklaces. Pinky, I was told that you would be a real inspiration to meet, and you, in fact, are.
Oh, thanks. I just do what I do. And
well, thank you so much for coming to talk
thank
with
you,
us.
Thank you, Bobby. I appreciate it.
Pinky Harris of Pinky's Cafe and Bayou Throws. That's it for this week's edition of Louisiana Eats, edible content for Louisiana food lovers. Have you missed an episode of Louisiana Eats? Hear today's show or catch up on previous editions anytime online at itsneworleans.com. And if you're not podcasting, it's time to subscribe. We've launched an exclusive podcast series, Louisiana Eats Quick Bites, made up of sneak previews of material that hasn't hit the airwaves yet and full-length interviews never heard on the show before. Visit our podcast page at poppytooker.com so you won't miss a single serving of our broadcast or our podcast. And give us a ring on our new committed phone line, 504-867-9128. We'd love to hear from you. Louisiana Eats is made possible with major support from Popeye's Louisiana Kitchen, Zatarain's, Camellia Beans, and Rouse's Markets. Additional support for Louisiana Eats is provided by the Shreveport-Bossier Convention and Tourist Bureau and from Palace Cafe, home of the Weekend Jazz Brunch, featuring a Build Your Own Bloody Mary bar located in the historic Whirline Music Building on Canal Street. Original theme music composed by David Pomerleau and performed by Johnny Sketch and the Dirty Notes. Big thanks to producers Joe Schreiner, Sarah Holtz, and Reggie Morris, and to our business manager and social media maven, Maddie Mulladew. Come visit us anytime in our Louisiana Eat studios at the Southern Food and Beverage Museum. Don't forget to find our recipes and see what we're up to at poppytooker.com. You can check us out on Instagram and Facebook, too. Louisiana Eats is a production of Poppy Tooker Broadcasting.